Philosophy. Descartes. Debate. The Mep Report. Mep Report. Mep Report. The awesomest discussion podcast in the history of the human species.
Oh, yeah!
Story is not going to be joining us for this particular MEP report, but he will be joining us soon for a future one, I imagine, but not right now. It's probably not the best time. So I'll just leave it there. So what's going on out there? Russ, how's life out in the VH?
Life's pretty good. I think since we met last, I made my triumphant return to stand-up comedy, so that was very exciting.
And you brought down the house, as I recall.
Yeah. I've had a bunch of really hot, successful shows, and I'm liking this new incarnation of myself as a comic, which, I mean, for years, I've had it stewing in my mind of what would I do if I got back on stage, and I was always conjuring up, like, these weird Andy Kaufman-esque characters that I would be on stage, like the weird chess teacher, or just the crazy Russian scientist, and just be this weird abstract comedian, but... As it happens, I just go up there and I'm completely present and in the moment and literally am ready to jettison my material at the drop of a hat if anything interesting is going on in the room, and then I'll just talk about what's going on. And just that level of ballsiness, I think, is what's making me more successful this time around. I'm not hiding behind my material or hiding behind
Comedy without a safety net, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great because it scares other comics and it scares the audience, and that makes me automatically funnier, I guess. So
you win. I was going to say you win in that process. I thought you were going to say that you get on stage and then, you know, you really didn't know what you were going to do. And so it's going to be like Tom Hanks in Punchline where you just start yelling at everyone and you're just kind of like, you know, you wouldn't know comedy if it bit you. Huh? What do you think of that?
Everyone's just like really awkward. That has happened. Like, I've had some really good shows. I've also had a show where I nearly got lynched because I just started cursing at the audience because I hated them and I decided to tell them what I thought of them.
Wow, so you're like a mini Michael Richards? Is that what you're telling me?
Why did you hate them?
I hated them because it was a giant open mic full of degenerate asshole comics. They were being completely unsupportive of all the comics that had gone up before me. And they just made the atmosphere so poisonous that nobody wanted to go up there. You can't go up and do material because they hate everything. You can't riff because they're like, oh, fuck this guy. I'm funnier than this guy. And they're like talking on their cell phones. And I had just no interest in entertaining these people. I just kind of wanted to get on stage and berate them for being terrible human beings. So comedy took a back seat to anger.
It feels like this is an extension of your Yankee fandom at a baseball game, Russ. That's because I haven't actually seen you in a routine. I've just seen stuff on, you know, videos and stuff, but I haven't seen you do a routine yet. So, like,
well, when it comes to things that I really care about, and I think as a life philosophy in general, I hold people up to a pretty high standard of behavior, especially when it's just common sense. Like, you're a comedian. It benefits you to make this show at least tolerable for other people.
You would think so, yes.
If you make it a miserable atmosphere, do you think a talent agent would ever come to this particular venue? Never. They would never show their face in because it's like a prison riot every time they have a comedy show.
I would definitely avoid it for this prison riots, I know.
And I'm the type of weird person that would go up and lecture a prison riot. Just say, now you people, is this really the way that you should be behaving?
Do you think throwing a metal tray at your fellow, so he used a shiv on you. Can't we forgive and forget about what
happened? So what did they do?
They just started heckling me to the point of them trying to drown me out and me yelling at them something to the effect of like, Yeah, great job with your half-written premises with one hand while you're masturbating in the other hand in front of your computers, you worthless sacks of shit. Well done, everyone. Well done. And then I just, like, walked off the stage.
This is what led to your sort of self-imposed isolation for a couple of years. You're like, then I wandered into the wilderness for a couple of years.
No, this was recently, Greg.
A couple weeks ago.
Oh, really? Nice.
This is the new Greg. Greg.
The new Greg.
The new Russ.
I definitely took an ego hit from that because I'd just been total success up to that point. I'm like, well, with this new strategy, I guess that's bound to happen every once in a while that I'll just – something weird is going to happen and I won't try to control it. I'll just let it happen. So,
well, as long as you don't all of a sudden start dropping races. See, that's the thing about Michael Richards is everyone's just like, you know, well, you know, if you're going to play the edge like that. I'm like, no, if you're going to play the edge like that and you're actually secretly a racist so that when you let all filters down, racism comes out. Like, that's when it's dangerous to do this kind of comedy. So if you know you're a racist and you don't want to be accused of being one, then you can't do this kind of comedy. But assuming you're not a racist, then – you know, even if you let your guard down, it's not like you're going to be like, and also racist slur. Oh, I mean, you know, which is more or less what happened to Michael Richards. So,
speaking of which, I actually witnessed an almost exact reenactment of the Michael Richards situation.
Really?
About a week and a half ago.
Or wow.
Maybe it was last Wednesday. I think it was last Wednesday. This really grizzled veteran comic, his name is Rick Shapiro. He was on the show Lucky Louie when Lucky Louie was on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
He played the weirdo neighbor who apparently did like a full frontal nudity thing at one point and had some short-lived notoriety from that.
Okay.
But he's mostly known as the comic, which is why Louis C.K. picked him, because he wanted to populate the show with other comics to get them work or whatever. So he's been doing it for 20, 30 years. He's like this 50-year-old, like, coked-out, shriveled veteran guy, but very brainy and very edgy, and he's really good. And in fact, my first triumphant show back, they put me up in the lineup right after Shapiro, which all the comedians were like, oh God, here it comes, because they knew that he was going to kill, and then they expected this kid who they like had to take the bullet to go up after Shapiro to just bomb, because how can you compare to him? And then I just got up and made fun of him for like half my act and totally got the crowd into it, and it was great. And he loved it too, and we met and everything. So last week he was performing again, and again they put me up after him. But this time the situation was, the crowd was just death. And the crowd just hated everything. I mean, to be fair, there were a lot of pretty shitty comics, like four or five in the beginning, so it took a while to get the crowd to believe that anything good was going to happen in the show. And then the MC was this black guy named Nico who was celebrating his birthday by drinking his face off, and so he got like progressively more drunk over the course of the show as he kept bringing up act after act after act.
Charming.
And he kept, like, he started off with this line, he's like, a black man hasn't been in charge of this many white people since Barack Obama. And he just kept saying it every time he got up between comics. He'd say it again, like, more and more belligerently, as if it were going to get a bigger laugh, like, the fifth time that he said it. And then he just started doing, like, 7, 8, 9 minutes of material between comics because he just didn't care and was pissed and it was his birthday and he was drinking. And he totally, like, single-handedly derailed the show. Not that the show was on a rail, but he helped to derail it from wherever
it was. He, like,
blew
off the rail, so couldn't get back onto the rail.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
So Shapiro gets up, and he's trying to, like, be present and make fun of this guy, and he says the N-word, like, several times in his bit. And, of course, this Nico did not think it was very funny. Because not only did he use the N-word, but he used the non-slang, like the full official N-word, not the one with the A on the end of it.
Yeah.
Which Nico said might have been acceptable, but this was not acceptable. So he almost did Michael Richards. Like, he started taking pictures of Shapiro with his iPhone so that he could send it to his posse, and he started, like, wrapping a towel around his knuckles so that he could, like, beat the crap out of him after the show. And then, so, like, in the midst of this, Shapiro ends a very mediocre set, and the audience is like, ugh, I hate everything. And Nico gets up, and he starts talking about this N-word lover, and, like, does another 8 minutes of belligerent material. And of course, I'm next. And they're like, all right, Russ, go get him. And so, instead of doing a set, my job was basically to defuse a race riot that was about to happen.
Which you did how, exactly?
That's what I did. I basically, I got up. And I was like, you know, first just acknowledging the situation. I'm like, all right, well, you know, I came here to do comedy, but sometimes you have to acknowledge what's going on. And this legendary comic came up and said, you know, the N-word, which Nico didn't appreciate, understandably. And he used the hard consonant at the end, which also he didn't appreciate. And then I just started riffing on Nico and kind of making fun of him, but in a good-hearted way. I was like, a black man hasn't been in charge of so many white people since Thurgood Marshall. And then I was just like, hey, give me that robe, motherfucker. And then I was like, a black man hasn't been in charge of this many white people since George Washington Carver. If white by white people, you mean peanuts. And then I was like, a black man, I just kept, I don't know, I was out of my mind. I mean, this is just what I do now. I just sit here and make up shit. I was like, a black man hasn't been in charge of so many white people since Darth Vader. And then everybody lost their minds. And then, so I had the crowd at that point. But then to get Nico back, I was like, Nico, I understand that you're upset, but I just want you to think about this. I was like, you know, we have a black MC tonight. We've had at least three Jewish comics. We've got a Korean comic coming up next. Do you know who we are, Nico? We are the Persecution All-Stars. That is who we are. Our grandparents went through some shit. All right, 50 years ago, yours were escaping from Selma, Alabama, and getting hit by fire hoses. My grandparents were escaping from Nazi Germany. And you know what? They knew that every step of the way, every beating that they took, and every person that tried to murder them just made their grandkids funnier. They knew that. And then that, nice. Like, everybody loved each other after that. It was great.
Super inclusive comedy.
It was like the reverse karmic thing of the me starting a riot at the open mic. So I felt like I'd cancel that out. So that made me happy too.
Very nice. You're like, thanks everybody, and listen to the Rep Report. Good night. It's like, what?
Yeah. By the way, podcast.
That's funny. Yeah, we that's well, I'm very impressed. I'm not surprised. I am reminded a little bit of I just reviewed a show yesterday for the Fringe Festival, and this reminds me of an example of something that you would – I started thinking about it because you were talking about things that basically go too far, and this is a classic example of a show that went way, way too far. So okay, so the Fringe Festival is basically like theater festival, but it's a theater festival for really edgy things that even like off Broadway wouldn't take, either because it can like.
And by edgy, you mean bad.
Well, okay, right. So I'll get to that. So sometimes it's because it's like blatantly offensive. Sometimes
yeah, I attended
because
part of LA's Fringe Festival.
Okay, right.
So
yeah, yeah.
By edgy, you mean bad or
sponsored by Michael Richards or this guy.
Yeah.
Or yeah, right. No, I mean it could be bad or it could be sometimes it is something which is like, you know, I think Urinetown got its start in the Fringe Festival. Sometimes, you know, it has something which even off Broadway won't touch and people go, wow, this is really interesting, and then it kind of moves up the ranks. So it can sometimes just be quirky. It doesn't have to be bad. And I've seen some good Fringe shows. For example, I saw one of the shows that I reviewed was called Saving Throw Versus Love, which has a big extended gaming session on stage, which was hilarious. So, I mean, you know, that's something which Off-Broadway isn't interested in, but everyone that I've heard thought it was really funny. And I think it's been voted so far like the number two show of the festival, and I gave it a good review also. So, but then we get the thing that I saw yesterday, and the thing I saw yesterday was a musical called Spellbound. Now, look. Going into this, this was a show I'm like, I'm obviously going to love this show because it's epic fantasy and it's a musical. Now, I love musicals. I love epic fantasy. Clearly, like peanut butter and chocolate, this is going to work, right? And I got into the thing, and I actually got in there about, you know, 10 seconds after the show was starting. So I got in, the lights had gone down, and I just heard these people were already out on stage singing about something, which is not unusual for a musical. So I sit down, and it turns out that the main character is singing with her aunt and uncle about this magic power that she has and what she's going to do with it. So she's – and so it's like basically like listening to West Side Story, except you'd have to replace like the Jets and the Sharks with like the Warlocks and the Giants, right? Right? So it's just like, we're going to rock it tonight. We're going to jazz it up and have some giants. We're going to use some dragons. We're going to shoot some flame. Like, I mean, it was like literally like you were watching a regular musical, except, you know, replace every normal musical song with like, you know, geeky fantasy stuff. Right. And like really not very cool costumes and like a very bad sound system and whatever else. And this guy looking like Gandalf storming around stage, you know, singing about whatever. Okay. So I won't even get all of the details, except I'll just say a couple of the highlights. Okay. The story is about this girl who needs to – she has this mana. Her great-grandfather was a grand wizard, so she's always wanted to be a grand wizard. But she's a girl, and girls don't become grand wizards, and so there's that. And she has to, like, learn to be a grand wizard, and she has to learn this from the teachers of the Three Scrolls. And she needs to
so
go
like
on this –
Karate Kid?
It's like I the wish next it Karate Kid. With
it's
Hilary
like the
Swank.
next Karate Kid. Yeah. It was like the rejected script of the Karate Kid. The problem with, I mean, first of all, like an incredibly cliched story. Secondly, the performers, and I hate to say this, but the performers just, maybe you can relate to this, I think. Certainly Clay can relate to it. I've related to it. Russ, I think you can relate to it also. You probably have comedians who I imagine who try for things that clearly they're not good enough to pull off. But they're like, but really good comics do X technique, and I can do that also.
Oh,
and
my God. I have the greatest example of this for you.
All right. So give me a second, and I want to hear it. Okay. So basically, that was the deal. And this is the same situation, right? Like, the musicians, they're just not good enough singers. So there are these things where they're trying to, like, stretch to hit these notes they can't reach, so they're out of tune. And there's nothing worse than having a musical which is not only out of tune, but out of tune shouting about killing goblins or whatever. Like, I mean, it's like Lord of the Rings, the musical version done by high schoolers. Because this musical got its start, apparently, at a high school in the Cayman Islands, where it was all the rage, I'm told. It was dreadful. And, like, every step of the way it got worse. Like, I was looking over and there were literally three people asleep in the row next to me. And I'm not making that up. Three people were asleep. And then everyone else had that kind of rutching around in your seat, don't really want to look up at the stage because it's really embarrassing, like don't want to, you know, and these people at this point are running around fighting each other, which mostly involves just like doing the Jedi thing, like the Darth Vader death grip where they like point at someone and everyone's like, you know, choking and doing really bad acting. And I was just like, I'm like, you know, I really want to like this musical, but I can't be like, it's fantasy, so it's okay. It was god awful. And I just couldn't understand why a musical would even be allowed to get to this point. There were 22 songs, 22 of them, each one of them worse than the last one. Like, they could have cut all of them and just had like 10 good ones, and that would have been better than having 22 lousy ones.
They have 10 good ones out of the 22 bad ones?
No, but I'm thinking maybe they could have combined a bunch of the bad ones, and by some random transitive property, it would have ended up good. I don't know. I haven't really thought this through, I got to be honest. You know, like
how many bad songwriters would trade their skills for that? It's just like, all right, well, you can either write all bad songs, or one out of every two songs you write will be great. They'll be like, sign me up. I'll take it.
And they list in the program. And one guy's like, well, you know, I'm self-taught. I'm like, well, yes, it shows. So I was just kind of like, this is a classic example of people going too far with a theme and then also really the reach exceeding their grasp by a significant amount. So at the end of it, and like people sort of uncomfortably laughing during fight scenes where clearly they weren't intending to, like, you know, have them laugh at the moments where they – it was cringeworthy. And I felt terrible because I'm like, great, now I got to go and got to go bash the show. And, you know, they're just being like, see, this is what happens when you put fantasy in a musical. I'm like, no, this is what happens when you put a bad musical on stage, fantasy or not. So I don't know. I found it frustrating. And I just want to say to those people out there, if you're going to do an epic fantasy musical, please do. And please make it not suck. Okay, please. So anyway,
I feel like there's one. Oh, no, it's a Star Trek musical that's out now that's like playing in L.A. that I've heard about.
Oh, really? Well, there's a good one-person Star Wars musical, too, which is supposedly amazing. I haven't seen it, but I heard there's a one-person Star Wars thing, which is really good, too. But just not this at all. I don't know. So you said there was a comedian who did the exact same thing, like stretched and didn't quite get there?
Yeah. You know how in George Carlin's old routines, occasionally he would do like a little rap piece or a rant that wasn't really a joke, but it was more just a series of things that sounded cool when he said them?
Sure, like, because it's George Carlin.
Right, so like, because he loves words and he was a linguist, and he would say, you know, you ever go into a bathroom with fluorescent lighting? Every cut, scrape, scratch, scar, scab, bruise, boil, bump, pimples, it, wart, welt, and abscess you've had since birth all seem to come back at the same time. And like, that doesn't make it funnier. He just likes to throw in those sorts of turns of phrase. So there's this one comic who's this little guy, and he's got curly hair, he's probably about 40. He's just got nothing up there. He just goes up there, he's got nothing. He only ever gets laughs when he, in the midst of telling a joke that's going nowhere, ponders as to whether he should be gay or straight or stop dating or stop doing comedy. Because it's like only the self-effacing stuff can ever work because his jokes just never do anything.
Great.
And his grand finale, which I've now seen like at least four or five times, is a rant about wheels where he tries to do this sort of thing where he comes up with this really clever phrasing or this clever concept of, like, humans need wheels. And so he goes through this, like, boring exposition of, like, you're born, and your mom's on a gurney, and then you're in a playpen, and you're on Hot Wheels, and then you get older, and you get a tricycle, and then a bicycle, and then a license, and you have your own set of wheels, and you drive around from work back and forth every day on your wheels, and then you like you become an old man, and you're in a wheelchair, and you go to the hospital again on a gurney, and you die, and you're reincarnated on the wheel of life, and it's all because of wheels. And everyone's like, ugh. Yes.
I mean, people, it's like you've had a revelation about something we already knew.
And I know, yeah, exactly. Wheels, good invention. Yeah. Very useful. We use them all the time. Great job. Like, not revelatory at all.
Now, and do you think that he thought he was presenting it in a way that people would find revelatory, or that he thought he had discovered something revelatory?
I guess he thought that he had discovered, like, oh my god, think of how many times in your life you use a wheel. Yeah! It's a wheel! It's like the most important invention in the history of civilization! Of course we use it all the time! It's a fucking wheel!
This is like the marijuana-induced comedy where you immediately find things funny just because, like, webcam. It's a camera on the web. It's a webcam.
Yeah,
you know,
by the
like
way,
that's
every
only
comedian
funny when
now
you're on pot.
Is like required by law to do a Facebook routine. It's sickening. It's like, you guys on Facebook? Let me tell you about Facebook. Status updates. I'm sad. And they just all say the same thing. And it's horrible.
Well, you know, it's funny because it's one of those things that I think since we all have a debate background, this is something that I've noticed recently. Since we all have a debate background, we're used to actually looking at and adjusting what we do based upon the external feedback that we receive. But it seems to me that a lot of these and that's the case especially when I'm teaching as well. I can kind of tell if things are, you know, being understood or not understood, or if things are working or not. But it seems to me that a lot of these people are just like, you know what? Bull in a china shop, putting the head down, going to do the comedy routine, even if it's horrible, going to stick to it because, by God, that's my comedy routine. And it's like there was this comic that Clea, when she was doing stand-up comedy a couple years ago, who would do all these impressions. And I must have seen this guy four or five times, and his big finish was like James Gandolfini, which was not funny. And he would do these things. First of all, every impression that he did – looked exactly like every other impression. Like, he could very well have decided to do Barack Obama, and it would have been like James Gandolfini or Obama-ish. And, like, he did it, thought he was hysterical, and it was never funny. And nobody ever laughed, and nobody thought it was interesting. And he did the same thing, and he would go on for, like, 5 minutes. And it was like he was cracking himself up like he thought people were – well, you know, it's sort of they're quietly understanding it, you know? Like, it's not like he had some super intellectual humor where he'd be like, well, they don't get it now, but wait till they get the joke and they're in the bathroom tonight. Or when they go to bed and they go, ah, I remember that fellow. I mean, it was not exactly very funny. Like, if it doesn't work, you're going to know right off the bat that it's not working. But he was like, no, damn the torpedoes, I'm going forward. And it's like, on our show, on the Mep Report, we don't have the benefit of that external feedback, I guess, except from each other. So we have to hope that we're being entertaining and funny, I guess. But it seems like most of the time in the rest of our lives, we can kind of recognize, you know what, this joke didn't go over so well. Let me try something a little different. And these people are like, no, must not take in any outside feed, must simply bull forward with my position, you know?
Well, because the types of shows that we were doing and that you might be doing, Russ, is, I mean, these aren't professional shows. So these comics aren't necessarily looking at this as an opportunity to make people laugh. It's an opportunity to work out your stuff. So, and sometimes it will take doing
it. But stuff wasn't working out.
But sometimes it takes doing it over and over and over and over and over again.
But
and slightly different changes, like the old Jerry Seinfeld of, like, I changed one word tonight, you know, in his act, can make the difference. The point is that your making is still valid, and that if it takes you years to do that, so long that the subject of your comedy now is like a decade old.
The guy finishes, he's like, I'm finally funny.
Hey, everybody, how about that CompuServe? That's crazy, that thing. You've been on the CompuServe?
Like, everyone's like, this is hysterical. They do send it back in time, but he's like the funniest guy
back
in 94.
Yeah. You've got mail.
Yeah. Hey, it's Hourglass Boy, because he's on AOL. That's a riot. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but Clea, I would piggyback on your point and say that in addition to it being comedians not always using their A material because they're working stuff out, also just the level of ability and the level of commitment that you get from people on those shows just aren't usually as much. I mean, there may be some comics who are working on their stuff, and then there are other comics who are just sort of happy that they lived out their dream of going up on a microphone and talking to people, and really have no aspirations of being serious about it, and so they just have their seven jokes, they enjoy listening to themselves tell their seven jokes, and they have no intention of getting better, because it's just not part of their goal set. And they just want to get up there and have fun, and they don't take it seriously.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And it seems strange, because you'd think that they would recognize that, you know, who knows who's going to be up there or going to be out there watching and is going to say, you know what, this is pretty sweet. And, you know, like recently I was contacted through, this just happened a day or so ago, through my website by this woman who's a jazz musician and also runs a website called wineandmusic.com. And she saw this review that I had done of Sting's Symphonicity album, because Clay and I went to see the concert a couple months ago and then we got the album. And I posted this review that I guess she thought was pretty good. She said, this is great. And, you know, we'd like you to review it for us. And presumably if this goes well, then they're going to, you know, take me on as a reviewer of music. And I just got an email that I'm looking at right now from her, which says something like, you know, oh, that's great. I'll get you a wine to pair the music with unless you have a suggestion. We have a sommelier at Wine and Music, and he's very good.
You're fired, Greg.
I'm like, so
fired. No wine.
About the wine, I'd like to pair this with sparkling cider. Greg, you've paired the last 15. Well, I'd like to pair this with sparkling seltzer wine. But anyway, I'm sure that, you know, once I explain that I don't know anything about wine, that'll be fine. And they could be like, I'll just review
it. And they'll be like, great, we'll send you a case of our favorite then.
I'll be like, awesome, I'll sell it on the black market. I mean, no, but the point is, like, you know, so there was an example. I had just wanted to post this quick thing on Amazon, but, you know, I took it seriously. And lo and behold, some random person on this pretty popular website finds it and then finds more about me and is like, hey, you know, that's pretty cool. And before, and upon further view, the guy who, you know, optioned my film found us because of us reviewing his show and reviewing a book at the same time, and then he got in touch with us, and then, you know, the rest is history, and that's going along pretty well. So the point is, it's like, I guess you can't think of yourself as always being on stage, but especially if you want to be someone in the public eye as a comedian or a musician or a writer or anyone who's got this kind of public persona, I don't know why you would just sort of blow off things and be like, well, this isn't really relevant, and so whatever.
I mean, because he's saying, Greg, that these people, this is them attaining what they wanted to attain, and just standing up here, not for it to go anywhere.
So all they want to attain,
they don't want to be in the
like
public
jackasses.
Eye.
They want to be public eye.
They wanted to conquer their fear of getting in front of the microphone, and that's pretty much
okay,
it.
Okay, but they've already done that. Why do they have to keep it? Like, can someone give them a medal and get them off stage? Like, congratulations, you've accomplished.
I mean,
now go back to your life.
Once you bungee jumped, I'm sure that you get a taste for it, even if you don't want to be particularly good at it. You just say, hey, I'm brave enough to do this. I'm going to do it again.
So if you bungee jump in this sort of theory, you bungee jump off the second floor of your house – and successfully managed to not kill yourself.
Yeah, that's pretty much your only goal.
Then you just do the same thing. You just continually bungee jump off the second floor of your house.
Yeah.
That's it.
The thrill isn't quite the same, but it's still some level of excitement and titillation from that.
So you're telling me these people's lives are so boring.
Yes!
That somehow
yes,
they
I am!
Their adrenaline
yes,
gets instituted. They're like, oh, adrenaline. Oh, adrenaline.
Yes, that's exactly adrenaline. What he's saying.
Oh gosh, I see. Well, that's I'm a little disturbed by that, but okay, that's fine.
Oh, the other thing I was just gonna say about on your comment of that, you know, you always need to be working on these things when you want to be in the public eye. One of the most exciting aspects of my run in comedy is the idea that every single audience is a valid audience, because I think a lot of comics fall into the pattern of like, okay, this is a shitty audience. I'm just going to practice material on them. I don't really care what kind of thing I get. I just want to get some notes on my stuff.
Right.
But for me, like, my goal is to have 70% improvised material and 30% written material.
Okay.
Every time. And that's pretty lofty. Like, I think right now I'm 50-50 at my best, and I just want to be able to extend that part of myself that can make up things for extended periods of time. And to be fair, I feel like in doing that I'm kind of playing to my strength because of, you know, the Met Report and debate and all, a lot of other reasons and things like that.
Sure.
But it's interesting because it's like you can't escape. There's no – I think in part some comedians can escape by just escaping into the recording of their material that's in their head and just like start the recording and do your material and then you're done. And in that way, even though you're exposed and you're performing, you're still protecting yourself from the reality of the situation because you're hiding in your material.
Mm-hmm.
In doing what I'm trying to do, there is no cover, there's no hiding. I literally have to be completely engaged with the audience or I fail miserably and utterly and like embarrassingly fail. And it's just, I don't know, it's kind of invigorating to do it that way, to know that like there's such a huge spectrum of how it can go. There's no risk management at all. There's like, there's no hedge, there's no insurance. It's all, this is going to be spectacular or I might cause a riot or any and anything in between.
Well, that's a little bit like Robin Williams. You know, Robin Williams kind of did a lot of that, you know, back in his real stand-up comedy days where he just did, like, straight-up, you know, improv, one or the other.
That and other people's material.
Yeah, a lot of stolen stuff.
I've also heard stories about Jim Carrey from when he was a comic that he would just be, like, completely different every night on stage, and a third of the time it was brilliant, a third of the time it was okay, and then occasionally the audience would hate him so much that he'd, like, sit down on the piano and sing to the audience, "I hope you get cancer," which actually happened one time, apparently.
Tremendous.
He made up a song called "I Hope You Get Cancer," because it was just one of those nights. And,
I don't know,
it's exciting. This is what I live for. I'm really, like, whether I get, you know, recognized for this or not, whether I become as good as I hope I can be, like, just that idea alone is exciting enough to make me very happy about what I'm doing. So
I wonder if you fall into patterns that with this improv, though. I mean, like, that's the thing with debate, right, is that we would, you know, people would tell us, like, I can't believe you just sit there and, like, after a seven-minute speech, you immediately have to get up and respond, and how do you have time, and blah, 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 blah. And a lot of it is just sort of recognizing patterns, right? Like, a lot of it is sort of, you know, things start to sort themselves into recognizable areas. So it's not like you give the same speech every time, obviously, but you sort of, you know, begin to group arguments. You're like, okay, this basically is this kind of an argument, or this is that kind of an argument. And so in our case, you know, and what you're talking about there, it's like, okay, this is a kind of night where I'm going to be able to do kind of this series of things. And that doesn't mean that you're like, okay, now open like box A for a series of jokes. But like, mm-hmm. I would imagine that these patterns sort of work, you know, where you begin to see them, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not just...
Yes, you're absolutely right in saying that. And that also does somewhat devalue my argument of that I'm being completely present 100% of the time. Because if I start, like, if I have some response that I've developed from improvising for so long, that when somebody says this, I know that I can get a laugh by saying this, there's a good chance that I'll use that if that comes up again in the future. In which case, I'm basically just doing planned material that I developed via improv. So yes, that's true.
Which means that the adrenaline you're feeling really isn't a legitimate adrenaline.
No, I mean, it's just a little bit more gray than I guess I presented it in the first place.
Your life is a planned life, Russell Goober.
No two sets should ever be exactly the same the way that I'm doing it, ever. And nor should they even be close. So basically, every single time I get up, it should be a completely unique show and a unique experience. And given that I'm responding to what's going on in the room, it should differ even if there are similar things happening to that happened another time in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm remembering, I don't know what author said this, but I think this came up in My Dinner with Andre, which is a movie that Story and I saw. Well, I mean, I had it here, but I showed it to Story when he was visiting before the calamity. and it really affected him. Like, it immediately became one of his favorite movies. And in part of it, they talk about this idea of getting lost in habit and people just going through their days and going through their lives not really being awake ever because they're just creatures of habit and repetition.
Sure.
And so there's one guy in particular who was so keen to resist this that he would do something completely different every day and like constantly try to remind himself and be aware of everything that he was doing and enjoy every morsel of food that's in his mouth and just try to enjoy every single experience because in a sense he believed that not doing that was not really living. And the only way to actually live would be to consciously enjoy every moment of sensory experience,
mm-hmm.
which is very, very contrary to the way that our brains work and the way that we cope, you know, with the day-to-day life.
And then he realized he was on the Truman Show.
So, I don't know, I was just reminded of that because that seems kind of related to the discussion about comedy and how to live in the moment. And I think for comedy, that's, you know, it's important to do that because anytime that you don't acknowledge something that's happened in the room, you're just that much less funnier. Whatever you're trying to do, if the audience's mind is on something that's happening and you're trying to take their eyes away from it, you fail because comedy's about revealing truth, and you can't reveal truth while you're trying to obscure something from the audience. You have
I think that's
to, you know, engage with everything.
That's an excellent point, and I think that I would sort of even get a little bit more warm and fuzzy about it, and I would say that really comedy is ultimately, the best comedy is about humanity, right? And so if you are literally disconnecting from the human beings that are watching your set and acting like they're not relevant, you know, then that's where you create this sort of rift between you and them, and the comedy isn't going to be successful. This is the same thing with music. I mean, this is why people will talk about the most amazing concerts they ever saw. A story posted on his blog about seeing this Counting Crows concert, and given his, you know, the situation that he's in, the Counting Crows concert definitely spoke to him directly. But it's also because they performed in a way that spoke to him. And I think we've had that happen where we've been to concerts where, you know, artists have mailed it in, and we're like, well, that really sucked. Well, the reason it sucked is because they weren't really there. They weren't really present. They weren't really connecting. And then there's other shows that I've been to where I'm just like, wow, that was amazing. And it was largely amazing because there was this great synergy. And that, of course, is the great thing about live performance, is you can get that kind of synergy. And I know it having been on both sides, having been on stage and then watching, you know, from the audience, watching from the crowd. And you really know when someone who's a musician or a performer or a dancer or a comedian is really connecting with the audience. And I think that's why when comedy, like when it goes wrong and it's way off, that's why it can be so devastating, I would guess, because it's like you completely missed. You know, it's like someone is like, I need help from you. And you're like, really? Let me pound you in the head with this mallet. And they're like, that was not at all what I needed right then. Now I have a hurting head and you hit me on the head with a mallet. You know, like, and so a lot of it is about being human. And yeah. You know, if you're not connecting with them on that human level, well then, then obviously it's going to fail, you know?
When I was in front of the audience of degenerate homeless people plus comics.
Right, the non-humans.
And I got, right, I got emotional on stage. I became angry. And that immediately erased my ability to perform comedy because I was no longer interacting with the audience. I was trying to inflict something upon them that they didn't want, which immediately becomes the least funny thing in the world is some guy lecturing you, which is the opposite of funny.
Yep.
And that's pretty much – and I mean I did. I learned a valuable lesson from that, which is that even if sometimes me riffing with the crowd would encourage them to interact a little bit more than a crowd normally would and does get to the brink of sort of a rowdy-ish or heckling atmosphere – my job as a comic is not to push back. If they push at me, I have to accept their pushing and acknowledge their pushing and comment on it and react to it. And if I don't do it properly, then I get the riot. And if I do it properly, then I get to be way funnier than I would have been otherwise.
Absolutely. That's 100% the same way in teaching. It's the exact same thing. You know, I could be one of those guys, one of those professors who does nothing but sit there and lecture, you know, like in the movie Teachers, where the guy's been using the same lecture notes for the last 30 years. Or I could be someone who actually engages his students in discussion, which is always what I've done. And that's not as easy, and it is sometimes dangerous, and it can sometimes create that environment you're talking about, although not very much, because I'm pretty careful to keep it structured, despite the kind of semi-freewheeling quality it may seem to have. It's also very structured. But nonetheless, you know, there is kind of a lot of my students, I tend to get very good evaluations, and they comment on the fact he actually is discussing things with us. And I'm kind of like, well, yes, that is sort of the principle of education, but they don't
Socratic
get that from a lot of
method, motherfucker.
A lot of the, exactly. A lot of their teachers, and I say that too. I'm like, let me tell you something. No. You know, it's like a lot of their teachers, I think, just give the impression that all they're supposed to do is just sit there and like baby birds with their mouths open while mama bird feeds them what they need to know. That is not the way I think you can be the most effective. And so these students actually feel like they're being heard and listened to. And it doesn't mean that I then sort of say, well, everything you say is exactly as good as everything every expert says, because, you know, although everyone has the right to an opinion, there are some opinions that have more support and evidence behind them than others. But the point is that at least they're part of the discussion. And it's the same thing whether you're a comedian, anything that involves you or an actor, anything that involves you reaching out and involving the audience energetically, implicitly, whatever, I think is a big deal and is important. And it's almost like some of these people we're talking about are like afraid or something of the audience, or they're afraid to involve them, or they're afraid. They're like, well, those are the unwashed masses out there. And it's like, dude, if you're not trying to speak to them, who are you trying to speak to exactly? Like, if you don't care about them, why are you here? Why are you in the front of a classroom? Why are you in front of, you know, a bunch of people who came to have a good time and laugh? Why are you doing it if you're not trying to reach them?
Yeah,
right?
Like,
you're not just up there for yourself, I assume.
It's such an old hackery tactic that a lot of comics will get in, and they'll see a smallish audience or an audience that's older than they expect or a little bit different, and they start complaining about their agent and said, you know, right after I did my comedy special, what I really wanted was to go into a room with 11 tired people. That's a... And then they get a little laugh out of that, but what they immediately have done is they've distanced themselves from the audience, they've acknowledged that this is not the audience they really want to be performing for, and they've disqualified themselves from being able to entertain that audience.
And they do it sometimes regardless of whether or not that's even legitimate. Like, I remember watching shows with comedians that Cleo would do stuff with, and the comedians are like, boy, tough crowd. And this is after, like, the audience had reacted well their first couple jokes. I'm like, what is it? Like, you chose, like, choose your own adventure? Like, if you want to go left, choose one. If you want to go right, yeah, choose one. Exactly. Like, I don't understand.
You know, so,
like,
the real reaction to that, if you're doing it right, is to say, okay, you're right, I needed a better tag for that. Or like, all right, so you guys aren't into this. Or some people, you know, some comics are like, fuck you, that's funny, and if you think about it, you'll like it later. And that can be funny, too.
Sure.
But they're speaking to the reality of it, not just being like, oh, you know, not being oblivious to the fact that how could my material fail at any point in time?
Or, but what I'm talking about here, too, is that their material worked, but because they're part of their act is to pretend that, you know,
oh,
like,
God, that's even worse.
If they failed, they're like, well, it failed. And you're like, but like, it didn't fail, they just laugh.
They build in the failure expectation. They're like,
is this my
tell a great joke, and they're like, geez, anyone awake in here? They're like, yeah, we just laughed at you.
We just laughed, exactly.
You're
are
like,
you
hello?
Deaf, perhaps?
Is this thing on? Sorry, this is just part of my script. I can't change my script. Anyway,
I got my teleprompter.
Just flew in from Tennessee. Still on script.
Oh my God, it's true. And that shows a sort of, you know, contempt, I think, ultimately for the audience, which is just not very cool. And that is, you know, it's weird. I guess that is sort of the danger of doing what we do on the show sometimes. Is like, we've talked about this before, we really should try to have a live audience sometime, you know, and just see the reaction that people have and if people are going to crack up or not. I mean, it would be playing without a net, obviously, but, you know.
We've all performed in front of audiences before. It wouldn't be
sure.
That new to us.
And if it was, we could just blame you. And we could just be like, look, this is Russ's fault. And dude, Russ is the, lead. You know, is the lead. He has a little more experience than Clea in comedy. And, you know, Greg is not a comedian. So really, it was up to Russ. And this was Russ's fault. And that way, we could savage each other on the show.
Yeah.
And that would
and
be entertaining.
Sure. Especially people like Story would agree that comedy is the only value that can be extracted from the Mep Report. So,
yes, absolutely, exactly.
Sure.
Yes, that's totally
that would
true.
Be his first comment. He'd be like, if it's not funny, it's not worth saying. Edit out all that other stuff.
You know, you only say it because it's true. So, have you heard the latest ridiculous celebrity news that Bristol Palin is going to be on Dancing with the Stars?
Yeah, let me preface by saying that, oh, God, I don't think we've done a Mep Report since I started working for Frequency. So let me just preface by saying I work for this company called Frequency.
Yes, that's right.
As a VJ. And part of my job is to know every nuance of pop culture trending that's going on and every second of every day. So I know every news story that's in the world right now that any respectable news organization has covered. I know every viral video. I've forgotten most of the viral music videos, but I know too much. I don't like, I used to do this for fun, and then they made it into slave labor camp, which was my job. And now it's like, okay, I enjoy not doing that for the rest of the day because I have no interest to browse the internet anymore after 7 hours of being plugged into the Matrix. But it's a little too much. It's hard to slow down my mind and think about it. So yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, so you heard about that. So it's like I you know, I mean, it's, I guess it's funny because it's just I think this is too bad that we don't have Story for this show, because it is a uniquely American thing where we can take someone who literally her only value is the extent to which she failed at her own alleged beliefs, right?
Yep.
And because of that failure, she's somehow come full circle and become this kind of minor celebrity.
Did
so
she
I think
with a disabled baby.
No, that's her mother. She's the one who, you know, preached abstinence along with her mother preaching abstinence, and then got pregnant with her, you know, boyfriend, who then they were going to get married, then they decided not to, and now he's got someone else pregnant, and then so
that's awesome.
And now she's like going around like lecturing abstinence to groups of nuns and things like that. So I mean, you know. But that's it. I mean, what you need to do to be successful is we need to sort of establish a very strongly held opinion, which you then turn around and completely go off from, and then sort of have this, you know, moment of coming to God where you realize that, you know, how wrong you were, and then you can be forgiven. So I think you need to do that. So I think first, Russ, you need to establish a very strongly held position and just be like, the only way to do it is to do X way. Then you need to very publicly, you know, be hypocritical about that by failing in some public respect. And then we can work you back into the public consciousness as being forgiven. And the next thing you know, you'll be on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, I mean, you know how much easier my career would be if my mom were like a celebrity moron? How much easier would that be?
Absolutely.
I could do whatever I want. Celebrity moron. There was this one of these terrible top 10 lists that I hate that are the only things that can be viral on the internet at any given time of 10 people who make less money than the situation from the Jersey Shore, who's making like $5 million this year for being a moron and being, you know, a charismatic
show I've never
moron.
Watched 1 second of ever.
I actually I saw it at I have a friend who has just a peculiar taste for just the most awful stuff. He and I saw Piranha 3D in the movie theater, which was so bad, but at least it acknowledged its own badness and the fact that it was just a campy, ridiculous movie, that it was really fun and cool.
Did it involve piranhas swimming at you, like out of the screen, like, you know, towards the audience?
Yeah, a lot of 3D stuff. But, like, the movie opens with Richard Dreyfuss singing the sea shanty from Jaws because it was, like, very self-aware. I'm like, awesome! References! And Christopher Lloyd was in it, and he was just like, 1.21 gigawatts? 1.21 gigawatts? Like, it was great. I mean, I couldn't believe how much I enjoyed it, given how horrible it was supposed to be. But similarly, I've seen at least one or two episodes of The Jersey Shore, and I get why it's so popular. Like, I understand. It's just a train wreck that just never ends. It's just an ongoing train wreck of these people who are encouraged with massive amounts of money to be the most hedonistic, drunken, moron clan in the history of the world on camera. And they have no control over it. They just were picked because they live these lives anyway. And now they're being pushed ever further to the realm of absurdity by, like, having to have sequel, you know, follow-up seasons and more money and being celebrities now. It's just so incredibly absurd that it's like rubbernecking. Watching is rubbernecking kind of thing.
Huh.
And my rant has cleared the courtroom, and that's
no.
Everybody's gone.
Clea has kind of this dazed expression on her face, and I wasn't sure.
What's
I don't think you've
on,
ever
Clea?
Seen.
Well, I mean, just
where are you at?
That kind of. I have issues with
Jersey and Shores, and put them together, and it's wrong. It's just wrong.
No, of envy. Where I just like, you know, I really hate that. Someone like me who, you know, don't want to toot my own horn, but I am kind of smart and somewhat capable. Maybe I can be funny and charming at times. You know, make nothing. And then you have
the situation.
Morons who I honestly can't even watch that stuff because I see the previews and what they do so just blows my head of how moronic and stupid and annoying they are. I can never watch that stuff.
Yes.
Like, I guess some people who don't have this envy problem probably can watch it and they find it funny because they're like, oh my God, like my life isn't that bad. Or, oh my God, that person is ridiculous. It's hilarious. But me, I watch this and I just think these people are getting paid exorbitant amounts of money for being this stupid. I hate this. I hate capitalism.
I mean,
I hate my life.
It's the celebration of mediocrity that's the problem. Celebrating how stupid they are. I mean,
they're not mediocre. The bottom of the barrel, like the worst humans you can find.
Celebrating
and put a camera on them without them shanking the producer. Like, they agree to live in captivity. That's the only redeeming feature that they have in the world.
Wow. I mean, and I guess, and it's funny because I think, you know, I don't know what made them think, and I remember hearing someone talking about, I guess it was the governor of New Jersey and some other people talking about, like, well, I don't really think it's a, you know, reasonable portrayal of New Jersey. And I guess the answer is,
it
really isn't. It's a portrayal of like, you know, if you took the worst group of people living in Alabama or people living in, hell, Washington State, or people living in, you know, Iowa or whatever, they would all end up looking this bad if you found the worst that you possibly could find, you know?
Yep.
So, I mean, and I guess it's because, you know, people don't find it that interesting to find people that are really smart and together, living smart together lives, I guess is the theory. I don't know. I was pleased to see that when Barack Obama showed up on The View a few weeks ago and they asked him about Snooki, he was just like, I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. I'm like, good. I'm very glad you don't know who that is. I actually don't want you to know who that is. I'm glad that you're focusing on the world and not Snooki. And there was a very brief, about 10-hour long Snooki gate, like he doesn't know. And then everyone was like, more or less like, I'm glad he doesn't know Snooki. Please get back to running the country.
There's no single thought in the history of his life that is worthy to be pushed out of his head by a knowledge of Snooki.
Exactly.
Nothing that he's ever learned should we be forgotten because of Snooki.
Kosovo. Well, you know, I'm thinking about Snooki right now. Like, no!
Clea, I mean, I'm very much in your camp. I've been avoiding this stuff for years. I've only caught an episode or two because, of, you know, I get trapped in front of a friend's ginormous TV and he has it on and and I find it to be a train wreck.
You can't resist the HD, Russ. It's your
density. It's true. It's true.
It is your density.
Sap media hound as anybody else. I don't really know what to say. Like, I agree with everything that you said. That it's the worst possible portrayal to put on TV because people will inevitably like emulate these morons just because they're on TV and because they make a lot of money. But I mean, still the consensus is like people acknowledge that these people are horrible people. It's just that the culture has devolved to a point where it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter that we're showcasing like the worst humanity has to offer rather than the best humanity has to offer. Like our value system, you know, if you took our value system from popular culture and especially from reality television, it would be completely the opposite of any way any rational person would draw it up, just because it's a race for shock value and ratings and money. And yeah, it's not good. It's not good. It's encouraging the wrong things. And
yeah, I guess that's just, I guess people don't think of it that way. I don't want these people to get benefit out of what they're doing. Why should these people?
Well, they don't get much benefit. They'll all be dead by the time they're 32. They'll have no livers left.
because they'll all have like skin cancer from constant tanning. And
yeah,
like,
they tan. They drink like you wouldn't believe. They just like one guy literally just like wakes up with a bottle in his mouth, and this poor girl who's like one of the nicer ones is like she thinks she's his girlfriend. And everyone in the country watches this guy go out every single night and make out with, like, 19 different women in a club, come back, stumbles home drunk, and falls into her bed. And she, like, lets him. And everybody in the world knows this is happening except for her because the show is being recorded at the time.
Oh, my God.
It's just horrible.
Wow.
It's just horrible. And the other women on the show are so cowardly and catty and horrible that they won't tell this. She's supposed to be their friend. They're all supposed to be friends. And they refuse to tell her that this guy has been just obviously cheating on her at every opportunity that he has because they feel like it's not even like a voting off show. Like, if it's Survivor and you're going to get voted off, like, fine, play politics. But they've been signed as a crew. They're all going to be there. It's like the third or fourth or eighth season of this nonsense. Like, they've signed. They're rich. They can do what the fuck they want, and they still don't tell her. They're just unredeemable pieces of shit.
Well, you do wonder a little bit if that reason is just because if they just realize, like, well, we can do whatever we want, and so we might as well just keep doing what we're doing. Like, I mean, you know, maybe the producers are right about this. Like, that literally is the life they would lead anyway. And they just happen to be getting paid for that life.
I think part of it is the producers are telling them not to do it because it would ruin the, like, unfolding drama. And, like, and a bunch of it's scripted. Like, the funny thing is that they perhaps don't say things dumb enough sometimes for the camera. So the producers will, like, write them a note and be like, I don't like all these tests that my girlfriend's giving me. She's giving me all these tests. If I wanted to take tests, I would have went to college. You know? It's like, did you just say that?
Oh, my God.
Like, it's so bad. It's epically bad. And
but maybe
again,
that's the point. It's so epically bad. It's good. It would be funny if all these people turn out to be actors and that they actually are not those people and they're just sort of like, well, let me, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe then I would be happy.
The one trend that I think you'll like, Clea, that doesn't glorify these people is that apparently there's a trend among marketers which is called anti-branding or unbranding, uh-huh. where they'll see Snooki, right? And the first thing that they'll do is if they're like, I don't know, let's say they work for Dior or something, they'll be like, okay, first of all, let's make sure that she's not seen anywhere being photographed wearing anything Dior. And then they'll send her a bunch of merchandise from a rival company so that she'll wear their merchandise so that, you know, their brand won't be ruined by Snooki. It's really funny because, you know, they want to be rich and wear all this stuff, but the company's like, want to have nothing to do with these people.
Wow. So you want to totally identify against anything that she could theoretically stand for. It's yeah. like the it's reverse like Tiger Woods.
Bombing yeah. your rival company by getting her to wear their stuff.
Well, they had, you know, Lindsay Lohan, as people may know, just got out of jail. Out of rehab after 21 days of what was supposed to be 90 days. I don't get that. But anyway, she walked out and there was this big thing about, you know, was this all staged? Because she had, you know, whatever her outfit was. And then she was holding some can of like a Rockstar energy drink. But it was like the opening was away from her mouth. And as she was holding it, like as if she was sort of showing it to the camera, like, you know, if you've, you know, when most 9 out of 10 celebrities coming out of rehab drink Rockstar drink, you know, yeah. like and so maybe branding has got to the point where they said, well, look, when you leave here, if you wouldn't mind just holding out Rockstar, that would be just tremendous with us.
Yeah, no, she's a hot commodity right now. She's
I guess.
I mean, they wanted to pay her $500,000 for like the first interview that they could get coming out of prison. Because even though it's not like an official tactic, like news organizations, quote unquote reputable news organizations, absolutely will pay cash for like celebrity interviews because they're all corrupt, douchebag, idiot, like not the fourth establishment, not even close, nothing, completely irrelevant, corporate sponsored, fatuous morons.
Yes, exactly. And you have willingly gotten yourself into. Gotten yourself into a job in which this is the kind of thing you do on a regular basis.
I know, because this is new media. This is supposed to be, we're supposed to take on the mantle of unseating the old media, becoming the new independent non-corporatist source of information.
I see.
And we'll see how well Frequency does that, but that's my personal goal anyway.
Is to destroy the corporate model from the, using the power of it. I see.
That's the whole point. Get the truth out there amongst all the drivel. The truth.
How's it going so far?
Truth in. I mean, you know, that's kind of the point of everything that I do. That's the point of stand-up. That's the point of mapping. Just to get a little bit of truth in there. Sneak a little bit in. Just a little morsel of truth amidst the mindlessness.
They're like they're eating a birthday cake. They're just like, is there a morsel of truth here?
Yes.
Like, no,
I hid a Flintstones vitamin in your birthday cake.
Oh man!
Oh damn! I cut my tooth on what was that?
Was that?
Morsel of truth?
That's called nutrition.
Oh. There.
Oh, that's man. Called nutrition, bitches. Eat it.
I was cinnamon bun of entertainment, and then I just found a raisin of truth inside the cinnamon bun of entertainment. That's really unfortunate.
The MEP Report, the Flintstones vitamin in the chocolate cake of the blogosphere.
That'd be a great slogan. We are the Flintstones vitamin in your pastry, you know? Although it's funny that the Flintstone vitamin is considered the big negative. You're just like, the last thing you want is a Flintstone vitamin.
I know.
You know,
well, you can't you can't start with like full on hardcore, you know, real vitamins. Just the Flintstones vitamin is the starter because it still tastes like candy and you can mistake it for maybe some breakfast cereal or something. Yeah,
that's how it works for us. When Senevine is not necessarily happy, we'll often give her two vitamins, which are two gummy vitamins, and she'll be pretty happy for a while and she'll start giggling. It's funny because she'll giggle when we find the thing that she wants to be like, like she's we've discovered what she wanted and she's just like, yes, you found what I wanted.
Like she's some evil, malevolent tyrant, be like,
excellent.
Yes, bring it to me. Excellent.
Except that she giggles in a very cute little girly fashion, not the way Greg did.
Oh, yes, kill them all.
Gummy vitamins.
Release the marshmallow men.
Here comes the birthday cake, Wonder Pats. Yeah. Oh my god.
Yeah, not so much.
She is, by the way, she is, since the last time we met, she watches sometimes Wonder Pets, which is essentially photoshopped operatic animals saving baby animals. That's what the show is. It's on Nickelodeon Junior. It's on Nick Junior. And it involves a guinea pig, a duck, and a turtle who live in a classroom in a schoolhouse, and when everyone leaves, animals in trouble call them, and then they sing about how they're going to save them as they dress in capes and then fly to find them and save them. And it's very – the phone is ringing. I'll be right there. There's a panda who's in trouble. You know, and it's all very, you know, operatic and powerful, and, you know, and they get there and like, you know, I need to save you, Ming Ming. You know, it's all this very dramatic, save you with teamwork.
Except and, a few seasons in, the turtle is anemic because the kids forget to feed it in the classroom. And the duck's been pet too many times and has, like, patches of feathers missing and sickly. No, classroom pets, not really good candidates for superhero pets.
Well, but that's exactly why it's such a perfect perfect secret identity. You know, no one would expect that, you know, someone would turn around and say that, you know. And it makes
doesn't even quack anymore. He's lost the desire to quack for years. No one to quack to. Just these gropey, gooey kids around all the time with their kid jelly hands and their lack of restraint.
I love that this is your image of the way classroom pets work.
I know.
Like their lack of restraint. I will pet the duck, ripping feathers. Like, I will now. I will get my jelly hands on the guinea pig's fur. Oh, matted fur. And now I will rip the turtle's shell. Oh, I have no shell.
You're telling me this is not what happens? That sounds like exactly what happens.
There is a teacher normally, Russ, who's kind of like in the classroom and is doing what we like to call supervision. That's in the biz, in its term.
But what do you know? You have college students. You're not in the classroom.
Yeah. Hey, our classroom pets, 20, I keep like, a total watch on
my I've had a class of like 6 5-year-olds I'm trying to teach chess to, and dear God, I'm like running a marathon. I'm like, get up from under the table. No, don't put that in your mouth. Would you sit up? Don't sit on the table. Look, it's a pawn. Don't eat the pawn. Oh my God, you ripped the king in half. You just killed the king.
Castle,
I have to do surgery on the king. What are you doing? No, we're not going to play checkers. This is chess.
Meanwhile, the 6-year-old's like, rook to pawn, to king's pawn, three. You're like, no, damn it, Dad. Meanwhile, you're Carl Sagan, you know.
Occasionally, if I'm lucky, I get one who can do that.
Have you been beat by a 6-year-old chess player, and are you embarrassed about
that? No, fortunately, I have yet to be beaten by any of my students. Although I have played some that were good enough that I definitely had to pay attention. Otherwise, I might have lost. So no, that hasn't happened.
Okay. Because if that happens, then by the martial code, then you must wander disgraced in the wilderness until you can return and defeat them, right?
Yeah. First, I have to expel them from class. I'm like, you have nothing more to learn. Yeah. You must go out on your own and learn more about chess now. You're a man. Or a woman.
Now I'm a teacher, but now you will be the master. Yeah.
That's exactly. I have to retire. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, this reminds me that yesterday I went to a shaman.
You did?
I went to a shaman and I had extraction and some soul retrieval.
Awesome! Yeah. Why didn't you lead with this?
Because she has to be careful about it. Like, as it is, it's taken a while to explain to the cops why half of the houses
That's
down our block
awesome.
Are now on fire. Because
what,
we, you
oh
know,
my God, Chris.
What
she
sort
fireball.
Of shaman was it?
Lakota.
So Native American shaman.
Right.
Yeah, we now have an astral jaguar sitting in our living room.
Oh my God, Chris.
Oh, an American shaman. That's unusual. Usually you have like Mongolian shamans or like Guatemalan shamans, but you got American shaman. You got a home made in the USA.
Homegrown, yeah.
A homegrown shaman. Why does it sound like describing a homegrown terrorist?
My shamanistic therapy is made in the USA. I'm proud to be an American. Charlie Indians treat my stuff. Okay, so
an American soul. Sorry.
Clea, tell us about why did you go, first of all? Why did you choose a shaman?
I have been feeling more psychologically stable now that I'm no longer sleep deprived and have a happy 2.5-year-old. And so I really would like to focus right now on my spiritual growth because I've never
had an astral jaguar.
I was never raised with any religion at all, and I do think that that is something that's lacking in my life is faith, and I do think that's part of a piece of that needs to be looked at. And
faith in the laws of thermodynamics are not good enough for you?
Right. So, since I've never...
She did like an arrow cutting. Did you see that? You like, how about this? And she's like,
group those arguments. No. Next.
The night.
So to 1A and C, no. Yeah. And moving on, since I was raised in a religion, but as I grew up, I developed these two things that I believed in. I believed that everything happened for a reason. And so if you don't know now what's the reason, you'll learn on later on. And that we all have energy within us. Either we have an energy body or we have energy, and we're all energetically connected. And that just kind of always, that's what just developed in my mind. That was, I believed it. And it made sense to me. And so when I decided that I was going to try to start working on this, you know, I started doing some yoga, and I don't know. I grew up in Washington State. Native American music always just really hit me in my gut and felt good. And so I thought, well, I wonder what shamans do. And when I looked up shamans, Native American shamans, like, they have two major premises. One, everything happens for a reason. Two, we're all energetically connected and we have energy bodies. Oh, these sound like these might be my people.
And three, fireballs.
Oh, God, Craig, the fireballs.
Ah, Dokken!
Did I ever tell you guys that I have, like a reasonably well-held belief that I was a shaman in a former lifetime?
No, did I ever tell you that I thought I was, too?
Really?
You're the same person. How about that?
Have you ever done past lives meditation?
No, never. It's just a passing thought of mine.
Okay, well.
I just sort of picture myself gibbering in front of a tribe somewhere and telling a story and being like,
Like someone from Fraggle Rock. Like,
it seems very natural to me. Also, ever since I was a kid, like, just out of nowhere, with no real inspiration to do this, I would like sing like African tribal music and stuff, and so I assume that's where this comes from. So
really? I see. Okay. That's entirely possible. I mean, I'm not one to believe in myself, and I'm not one to kind of say yes, this is what I believe. So I always hedge my bets. But let's putting that clear aside for the now. I would say that you probably were, and part of your soul is remembering that.
Yes.
And I did some past life. It's called past life regression. And when I had two separate images. The first time I went into meditation, I saw myself as a young shaman. And I was very focused on my practice. But I was in love with a young girl, and she cared about me, but I couldn't be with her because I really wanted to focus on my practice. Mm-hmm. So there was always that longing there. And then another one, I was a very, very sickly, physically ill girl, and I couldn't really even walk very well. But I was very wealthy family. But I really couldn't do anything. And I just wanted to just move and be comfortable in my body, and I couldn't. So those are two images that came to me. So I called up this woman, and she's very sweet. And she's like, so, you know, why are you coming to me? And I was like, well, I kind of want to do some spiritual growth, kind of tune into my inner self. You got anything for that?
I'll take one. Yeah, it's called Zoloft. There you go.
Inner self this and call me in the morning. I got to go deal with the astral jaguar. Give me a break.
Don't take it with your nightcap.
So it felt a little awkward, but she made me feel comfortable. And so I went in, and she first does the extraction, and she extracted, supposedly,
it's like a tooth.
They believe that in certain phases in your life, either in a traumatic event or something had happened, and an energy, either from another soul or an energy from something else, can lodge itself in you, and it changes your energetic aura, which then can affect who you are. So in this phase, she extracts that foreign energy.
Where did she put it?
She sucks it out and then just, I think, just puts it back into the cosmos. I don't know. I didn't.
Well, that's a little bit irresponsible, isn't it?
I don't know. I could ask her what she did. All I heard was her go,
"Isn't there a proper disposal for these things?" If somebody walks in the room and now all of a sudden they're sad and feel a need to stab themselves in the leg because you had this extraction and she didn't dispose of it properly.
Well, I mean, she does have has a spirit god who's a shaman, Ten Fists, who also comes.
His name is Ten Fists?
He comes.
This is so awesome.
He comes to help, and so I'm maybe he takes it.
Well, yeah,
maybe
he battles with
it.
His ten fists. It's freaking awesome. Look, it's a spirit. Ten Fists. That's really, or she like puts it in him, and so he like has every bed. He's like the living version of the Ghostbusters trap.
Right, well,
and
that's
walks
what
around
say,
and he's
actually.
Just like, you know,
he's like, light is green, trap is clean.
But you know what happens at Ghostbusters, boys and girls? Eventually, Ten Fists cannot hold in the spirits any longer, and that's
because the EPA comes and shuts down your containment system.
Right,
Ten Fists doesn't have to deal with that bureaucratic crap, man.
But there's probably a shaman bureaucracy, right? You'd think there's got to be someone who's just like, all right, have you filled out your forms and
council?
Exactly. Damn you, Elder.
There's got to be 6 weeks. We have answer for you.
Well, there has to be. Doesn't there have to be like a village leader or like a newcomer from the outside who comes in and then like the shaman is pissed because he like takes away his, you know, nobody lists as a shaman because they're paying attention to the outsider. So there's got to be a lot of that going on, right?
Where, like, you're trying to come up with some example where like he's taken away his badge or something.
Right,
like,
exactly. And then the shaman's just like, I will have my power
I'm
back.
I'm going to do it anyway.
I will destroy you. I am Ten Fists. You know?
That's when he becomes a brujo and he makes a movie about a Native American renegade witch who like curses people and stuff.
Right. Played by Lou Diamond Phillips, no doubt.
So
they
she
did the extraction.
Yep, there was something stabbing me in my right lung, and then then she said there was, and she worked on my knees, both my knees, and she said there was something there from childhood, and. One thing I can say from that is that usually when I lay in place and my legs get a little chilly, I get crampy. I get like restless leg. And it had rained that day and my pant legs were wet. And so I had concerns that was going to happen. And I didn't. My legs did not get crampy at all. Hmm. And I have to say, even right now, it's a little chilly in here. And because I'm wearing shorts and normally I'm sure they would be cramping by now. And they haven't. I haven't had that since. And then she does soul retrieval, and in that they believe that a traumatic event or situation arises, and part of your soul breaks off to cope, to help you cope. And so she retrieved a 4-year-old girl and a 7-year-old girl. She said the 7-year-old girl was on a throne, was with a deity, being protected by a deity. And she came back and she brought a black box for me that she wouldn't show the shaman what it is, but she says it's for me to put my treasures in. And then she saw a 4-year-old girl who was way, way back in a cave. And there was a rabbit spirit guide that was with her and keeping her company. And from that, I just thought was very interesting because I've always had an affinity for Alice in Wonderland. So when she tells me that my 4-year-old self was in the back of a cave with a rabbit, I just thought that was kind of funny. I thought that was interesting.
Is that like your spirit animal?
Well, yeah, I actually had 3 spirit guides, which I felt, wow, geez, because I was just expecting to be told of one. But so one of them was the rabbit that was protecting my 4-year-old self. And in those 2 ages, there were events that happened. When I was 4, my parents divorced, and my mother kind of pulled away a bit. And when I was 7, my mom tried to come back into my life. She moved to a town where she thought I was going to be going to first grade, and my dad ended up changing the plans, and so she moved there, and that meant that she ended up moving further away from me. She was further away from me, and it was very hard on me because I really felt really felt very bad for her, and I felt very upset that she was making an effort and it failed because of, you know, what happened. So that was very hard for me. I remember that. When she was doing the extraction, a large moose spirit came in and laid down on me to protect me and keep me warm, which she thought was, you know, she'd never had that happen before. And then before I got there, she said they meditate and try to enter your essence. And she said that when she first tried to enter, there was a ladder and it was horizontal. And so it was very difficult for her to climb. And she said then once she started climbing it, it was like moving all over the place. She said it was like practically impossible, this ladder. It kept moving, and there was this black, just swirling stuff below her. And she said it was just like so hard. And then she said she finally got in and she saw me with this beautiful white flower right next to my face that I could see and touch, but I couldn't see its beauty. And she felt, okay, you know, I need to help you see its beauty. And then she, you know, kind of got the sense of this furry creature walking around, and she said, okay, can you please show yourself? And it was a bear. And she saw this moon rising. So there were a lot of feminine symbols mm-hmm. when she was meditating on my essence. And that also touched me because over the last couple of years, I've been really trying to connect with my feminine side because I was raised by a single father. I was raised by a single father who was not very supportive of the feminine. And so I've really been trying to reconnect to that in numerous ways. And I've been attracted to that numerous ways. I went to an all-women's college. I think I did because I was so in need of that. I've read some books and stuff like that where I hear about feminine communities working together in tandem, you know, teaching and guiding and helping and supporting. And that sounds so wonderful to me. So that was another part of it that was, I thought, going to hit home. So that's that. And she said, and at the end of it, she said, okay, so the next step is I do two things to it. You know, I would teach you how to journey. So she teaches people how to journey into the animal realm mm-hmm. so that you can go down, because they believe that the lower realm is not hell. The lower realm is where the animal spirits live. And so you can go down and just chill out with your animal guides.
I bet your husband fantasy author is like frantically jotting notes down right now. He's like, yes, the wolf spirit said what? Where did he tell you to go? Swirling matter, swirling void below, got it.
At a certain point, like, you have to be able to channel and then use them to defeat your enemies, though. That's the problem. This is like the end of the fantasy novel is not like...
If it doesn't have fireballs, he's too...
No. I mean, like, he doesn't have to have fireballs, but at some point, the spirits have to be able to work together. And then all the wolf and the bear, and they would use them to defeat the creatures of the night. Like, that's, you know...
He just keeps crossing out the word Klee and writing Arvin. Then Arvin climbed up a ladder with swirling blackness. Then Arvin found... a white flower.
And the moose lay on top of you to keep you warm. But the moose had spikes and eyes of flame. Like, you know, then we're talking about...
Exactly.
So Dune showed up for no reason. What?
Anyway, so that's the next thing.
Then the Dark Lord came to the mouth of the cave, and then...
That she said is that she'd teach me how to journey so I can go down and hang out with my spirit guides and either go down to ask them a question or just go out just to be with them, she said, because... She says that's where you feel the most love she's ever felt is being with her animal spirit guides. And then she also has a sweat lodge that she does. So of course, whenever I mention sweat lodge, people are like, oh, where the people died. I'm like, well, no, that was some random people in a cult. They weren't Native American. They weren't in a Native American shaman sweat lodge. But anyway, so she also does sweat lodges. Usually she does one a month. So I might do that because she usually just does anyone's welcome. But one of her other clients requested a all woman one. And so that just, I was like, oh, well, I definitely would like to do that. That'd be cool. So we'll see. That might be my next step, is I will do the all women Sweat Lodge. So now all MEP listeners can picture a bunch of women together sweating.
Yeah.
All of a sudden,
our
ratings shoot up into the stratosphere. Maybe. Or it was like, what was that show about? I don't know. There was a lot of stuff about comedy and something about Spare Guys. But at the end, there were sweaty women. And let me tell you what.
They had a sexy pillow fight, and now they're sweating.
Outstanding. Well, speaking of that, we are past the hour mark here. And since I'm sure Clea wants to contact her spirit guides again, the moose, the bear, and the rabbit are all chilling now. And they're just like, let's go. We're going to have to move on to the end. We want to thank everyone for listening as always. And please check us out again soon. If you're in the LA area, make sure that you go see Russ and sort of, you know, push the envelope. See whether you can get Russ to, you know, maybe to break a little bit, you know. Don't give him Michael moment, just sort of, you know, try to be edgy, try to kind of, you know, stretch out and see what the deal is. And if you're a member of the show that I reviewed, I'm very sorry, but your show was bad, and I really hope that that you will be part of a better show in the future. We'll see you guys soon. Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
And remember, folks, always dispose of your spirit fragments properly.
I have to get my cousin 20 Fist to bring this one out. I hate 20 Fist hates
only
me now.
Only you can prevent forest fires.
Who's that? It's 30 Elbows. Oh, man.
30 Elbows.
I hate 30 Elbows.
I don't want to have to designate your soul as a Superfund site, okay?